The Red Lamp District, Episode 6, As Kingfishers Catch Fire, by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hello and welcome to the Red Lamp District. Hello and welcome to the Red Lamp District, Episode 6.
Ba-boom.
Ba-boom. Yeah, the good old Episode 6 ba-boom. What's up, Chris?
How's it going?
What up, Chris? I'm about to. What up, Chris? Because that's what I was born to do. I don't even know. I think
those
it's like warm it up.
Warm it up.
Yeah, warm it up.
I've never heard that before, though.
You've never heard that before?
No.
I'm just kidding. It's
Crisscross.
Crisscross, right? Yeah. Good old 90s hip hop. 90s kid hip hop. All right.
Wear the clothes backwards?
I still do. isn't that how you're supposed to wear your clothes after the 90s?
That explains a lot.
Yeah. So, today we're going to be talking about a poem while we drink tea, right? As Kingfishers Catch Fire by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Taking a little bit of a left turn on you. Mm-hmm. Taking a little bit of a left turn away from the deeply religious talk. Or are we? Yeah. Or are we? That's the question.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, as always, what's been on your mind since the last episode,
man,
Chris?
Man, oh man. On the mind? So I'll just tell you a little snippet from my work week.
Do it.
All right. So, my boss comes in the back, says, "Hey, Chris, will you take me to the auto parts store?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Sure, man. I'll take you on the way home." So we're driving to the auto parts store. It looks like he has something like he wants to say.
Yeah.
And
ruh-roh.
No, it's good. It's good. Well, no, it's just like a shock.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's just amazing. I don't know. It's a shock. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's everything. It's like a hole blasted in the wall.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So he starts to tell me about what he's been watching on Netflix.
Okay.
I wish the people could have seen your face. That was cool. So he's like, "Oh, pull over here. So I pull into the Sonic.
Uh-huh.
He's like, we go around the back of the Sonic. He's like, he says, "I've been watching these World War II documentaries."
Hmm.
"And in particular about the concentration camps and the persecution of the Jews."
Oh, man. Yeah.
So he just started launching into this description of what he learned.
Wow.
And it was like time stopped.
Dang.
We were just both, our jaws were dropped.
Just another day at work for Chris
talking.
Hackett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just like, "You have to watch this. Do not watch this with your wife. My wife wouldn't watch it with me, but you have to watch this. You have to watch this.
Yeah.
So he said, you'll never be the same. So he watched several of them. One of them was like the documentary that Dwight Eisenhower required the, you know, army to do as they were liberating the,
yeah, liberating the concentration camps. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I don't know. It was just like our normal daily life.
Yeah.
Sort of went far away.
Uh-huh.
And like these bigger, horrible things that happened, these bigger realities that we just can't even comprehend, kind of came to the foreground.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Man.
It was amazing.
That's heavy.
It was.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's like one of those things.
Yeah, that's that brought to mind the article that you texted to me yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even planning on saying anything about that, but spontaneously brought to mind that article you sent me about Herman Wouk.
Mm-hmm.
And his I think you know that I'm a big fan of his books, Winds of War and War and Remembrance, which are all about, it's like historical fiction of World War II. It's about this American naval family.
Mm-hmm.
And just basically their experiences during World War II. It's like epic, like really long. And it's so good. I've read it. It's super long, so it's not one of these you can just read over and over. But I've read it I read it when I first graduated from the Naval Academy and was just entering into the, you know, the wider Navy myself. And then I listened to it on audiobook last year and again, and it's just so good. It's one of these that they made like a mini series of it back in the '80s, but it's, you know, it's like '80s quality mini series.
Right.
It's fine, but it's not great, but it's one of those that I think would be great mini series if they did now, you know, with the kind of modern standards of doing those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But I remember being really impacted this time by that aspect of it, the Holocaust aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it's almost like I don't know if I had like, I think maybe hearing it read to me in audiobook form was different than like reading through it,
mm-hmm.
because there's some really just, what's the right word? It's on the tip of my tongue and I can't think of it, but there's just some really like gripping scenes where there's this woman in the story named Natalie, and you know, she's like she marries one of the, she marries a non-Jew, but like right before the war starts or just as it starts, and they have a child, and he actually, like, he's in the American military, so he never actually meets the child until, like, you know, much later in the story. And she is basically an American, like, kind of non-religious Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And she, like, doesn't leave Europe until it's too, and, like, doesn't try to leave Europe until it's too late, and then can't get out. And so she's, like, trapped in Europe, like, trying to run from the Nazis, trying to kind of lay low and not get into a camp. And she ends up in a concentration camp with her uncle. And there's just a few scenes in there where when you listen to them, you're like, it, like the full, I can't say full, but the horror of the Holocaust, like, just descends upon your mind, you know, just this incredible, the almost like supernatural, and it's not like all woo woo. It's like very like real. It's a very realistic portrayal, but the supernatural, almost a supernatural horror of it.
Yeah.
You know, that human beings were capable of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, it's just an incredible book altogether for so many different reasons. You know, it brings in all kinds of like discussion of philosophy and like the kind of worldviews and conflict, but it's full of action too. It's just really like an amazing book. But maybe you can mention to me some of the documentaries he mentioned in there.
Mm-hmm.
But and I can maybe link to him or mention him in the show notes, but
Cool.
You know, that's another one that's what sprung to mind after mm-hmm. you mentioned that to me, and
interesting,
makes me think of worth mentioning. But did this seem to be like a really do you think your boss was like changed by this in some way, like or just kind of shook and shaken to his core?
Yeah, it was one of those. Yeah, I think just shaken up.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just, you know, he spent all, we kind of binged on him.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he wanted to talk about it.
Yeah,
yeah. So
yeah, well, one of the things I remember from the from Wook's novels is he does a really like, he kind of has the main part of the story, but then he'll have like a chapter where it's like, it's almost like a divert. It's almost like, it's not part of the main story, you know, mm-hmm. but it's like a little snippet from something.
Yeah.
And so there's this character that he has that's like, I don't know that it's ever actually a named character. It's just some like German, you know, or, you know, it's some like Nazi official who is in charge of like setting up the Auschwitz concentration camp. And it just goes through like, I guess death camp maybe is a better term for it. But, it just like goes through his perspective of everything that's like the setting up of the camp and like kind of slowly becoming, you know, realizing what the camp is for and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And part of the horror of it is just the like how mundane it is to him. mm-hmm. you know, that he's that he's setting this camp up for the purpose of killing all these innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
And and just through his eyes to like see the dehumanization of these people. Yeah. And so I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely heavy reading. The whole book is not like that, but it's just part of it. Like it's part of the whole epic sweep of the story of World War II, really. Yeah. So wow, that's a pretty you know, that doesn't happen to you every day.
No. It was you know, in a way it's as if you do, the things, the atrocities like that are horrible things in your life or serious pain that you've ever experienced. I don't know if you like, you know, I think you had your appendix taken out. That's probably pretty painful.
I have not had my appendix taken out, but I did have my gallbladder taken out.
Yeah. It was probably a painful thing experience before, you know,
the gallstones were particularly painful. Yeah.
But you know, you don't really, our memories are interesting because you sort of, the horror, the pain or the struggle or suffering of it kind of fades away. And I think our memories can be a bit selective for towards the good or the pleasant or the, you know, the easier or the,
it's almost like it's how we get by, mm-hmm. you know, it's how we continue to, to move on. But yeah, that thought, like after you, that a similar thought crossed my mind, like, cause you listen to things about this and it, you know, it affects you deeply and you're just kind of like, wow.
Yeah.
Or you see a movie, you know, that depicts something that's really, really difficult to come to grips with, and somehow you move, somehow you're like forced, you're forced to move on. I mean, you gotta move on in your life,
mm-hmm.
To other things, but it does seem a little bit absurd to think, you know, to like think that like we're living in this world where this happened, you know, and just kind of going on with our daily business.
I know.
And this happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It doesn't fit with the rest of the storyline in a way, or the experience,
or it doesn't seem to. Yeah
exactly.
I don't know, it's almost like a psychological and spiritual and emotional defense mechanism,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah exactly.
Just the struggle to move on, you know.
Yep.
Well, cool, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, man.
Well, cool. I can't really say cool about it, but like interesting, fascinating,
right?
Philosophically cool.
Yeah.
So, all right. Did I mention that we can really bring the darkness on this show?
Hey, man, I'm trying to keep it real.
We are the Red Lamp District. That's what we do. It's about the light and the darkness.
That's right.
Because it's a dark world we live in. We sometimes forget that. You got to acknowledge the darkness.
Yep.
So that you can see the light or something like that.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Yeah. I was kind of thinking about like, you know, taglines for the show, and one that, you know, I kind of like is, what was it? I'm going to butcher it now. I try to say it off the cuff, but, break faith with the darkness.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. I kind of like that too.
Yeah.
Copyright 2019, John Carswell.
That's good. All right.
Break
faith with the darkness. And then it'd be like a picture of us in like superhero.
That's right.
Stuff.
Like, or really you cool. Just, or you just have the red lamp.
Yeah,
the real star of the show, Chris. It's not about you and me.
No, I know. I forget that.
I'm the only one that knows this on the show. All right. Okay. All right. Well, we are going to talk about As Kingfishers Catch Fire by Gerard, the man, Manly Hopkins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about a poet, man.
Seriously. Talk about a poet. So
do it.
I thought, well, I'm going to, if you'll let me get to it. All right. So, Gerard Manley Hopkins, little short bio on him before we get into, the poem itself. Born 1844 in the greater London area. He was the son of a poet, his father, and a musician, his mother. Now, I don't think they were like, I don't think they were like professional poets, mm-hmm. and a musician. His dad was like a businessman, but he did write a lot of poetry, and he was known as a poet. And then his mother was a musician, so it was kind of an artistic family, right? Okay. He came from an artistic family that encouraged him to get involved and to explore his artistic and creative interests.
Mm-hmm.
So they were also a very religious family. So they were Anglican, mm-hmm. right? High Anglican.
Okay,
and so he was exposed to that tradition, and of course one of the key figures in that tradition at that time was John Henry Newman, who was still, you know, still an Anglican bishop at that time.
Okay. But part of the Oxford movement.
Part of the Oxford movement. Going on. That's right. That's right.
Which is?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Yeah. Essentially, the Oxford. Well, we can say this. The Oxford movement was essentially Anglicans who wanted to get more in touch with their with church history.
Yeah.
Like feel a deeper connectedness to the tradition of Christianity, to the more ancient traditions of Christianity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I put it in a very
theologically, liturgically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's an interest in instead of becoming more Protestant, maybe going up just to the edge where you can feel comfortable with Catholicism, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And Catholic influences.
Yeah.
So, but maybe not all the way over. Not all the way over, at least at first. He did have what I found really interesting, and was that he had this ascetical streak even as a boy. I wrote that as street in my notes for some reason, but probably autocorrect. He had an ascetic streak. So he would, like, one time I was reading that he tried to, he's like 10 or 11 years old, and he tries to go without water for a week. He's like,
what?
He's like, people drink too many liquids. And so he's just like, I'm going to see if I can go without water for a week. And he, like, he got to the point after a few days where his, like, tongue was black, and he, like, passed out, because he went to, you know, they had to do, like, drill in school and that kind of thing. So he passed out on the drill field.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, you can't do that so much. You can't go without liquids for that long, unless you're some kind of, you know, like, saint, right? That's, you know, that God has granted a special grace to for that, but don't count on that. So I just found that interesting. This is something that kind of comes up again and again in his life. He had this pull towards asceticism throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he began writing poetry in his youth. Again, encouraged to do that. He was Oxford educated.
Yeah.
And
he knew his classics.
He did. He most definitely. And
languages.
And so at the age of 22/23, he converted to Catholicism under the tutelage and influence of John Henry Newman in Birmingham.
Okay, so he knew him personally.
Yeah, they knew each other personally, so he was kind of a disciple of Newman. And by this time, of course, Newman had been a bishop, but he converted to Catholicism sometime before, which was a, you know, very big deal in England, because Newman was a very famous figure.
Yeah,
and his conversion was a really controversial thing, mm-hmm, because it was just something you didn't do. You didn't become Catholic in England at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's still, even today, you would know, because you lived, mm-hmm, you would know, have some better sense of this.
Yeah.
You lived in England for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is just, like, there's just, even still, there's kind of this sense in English society. I mean, I think people are a lot more tolerant now, but, like, but even still, there's just, like, you're not, like, Catholic is not the normal thing.
It's not English to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the to become the king or queen of to reign over England, you can't be Catholic still.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe I might get this wrong, but what is her name? Meghan, whatever, who just married
Merkel.
Prince Harry.
Yeah, man.
Didn't she have, I think she was, like, baptized Catholic and had to, like,
renounce the Pope, or
I don't know if she had to renounce the Pope, but, like, I renounce Pope Francis.
What'd she have to do?
But I think she had to, like,
say some oath to the Queen.
I think she had to, like, formally join the Anglican Church or something like that.
Okay.
I may be wrong about that, but I remember there was something about that.
Well, I know in the royal family extended, there's Catholics now.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
It's pretty far out. In the family.
Yeah, maybe it's like if Prince Harry ever becomes, by some stretch, ever becomes, because I know Prince William is the one who's supposed to be in line for the throne, but if Prince Harry were to ever become...
Well, I think Charles is in line. Did he renounce that?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think he still wants to.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to talk about the royal family.
Come on, man. That's really exciting and fun.
What is this?
Let's
this The View or something like that?
Let's talk
that?
About, like, the royals. Did you see what Meghan was wearing?
Oh, God. Oh, my gosh. Isn't she gorgeous? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. What are we even talking about? All right.
So, anyway.
Totally, yeah. We got to, like, edit that out. All right.
No, we won't. It's cool. Keep it in, man.
All right. So, I wanted to throw this in there. So, like I said, he converted to Catholicism under Newman in 1867. And this is in Birmingham, which I don't know about you, being an American who's never actually been to England. I mean, you have, so you have a better sense of the landscape over there too.
Yeah.
But I like, to me, it's like London, mm-hmm. and then like
the rest?
Scotland.
Oh wow, yeah, yeah.
Like that's my like geographical layout of of England for
right.
me.
Okay.
And I have some sense that like Manchester is a little bit up north, because soccer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But you know, I've heard of like Birmingham and other places like that, but I don't have really any sense. I never really had any sense of the geographical layout, mm-hmm. but I've been reading Tolkien's biography again. And so I've been using Google Maps as I read it to try and like map out all the places. But basically Tolkien grew up in, you know, his stomping grounds as a young man was basically Birmingham, like the city of Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And after Tolkien's mother, converted, his like the center of gravity for his family was the Birmingham Oratory, which Newman had I think founded or played a big part in, right? Can you explain what an oratory is for those?
Yeah, so
you may
the,
not know
the oratory. Well, probably.
Okay, give me your best shot.
Okay,
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah,
so.
I think it was Philip Neri, Saint Philip Neri.
That's
he
right.
Founded the oratory in Rome, I think. So the
yeah, that's right.
And I think it was his interest. It was a sort of counter-reformation movement, mm-hmm. but he wanted to, it emphasized preaching and, you know, young people, and they wanted to sort of, you know, help the profligate young people like return to the church.
Yeah.
In the crazy party city of Rome,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so he founded these oratories. He was evidently a really charismatic guy. He was a practical joker, I think. And
yeah.
Really interesting person.
Yeah.
But he found, had this movement that really grew, and they would meet sort of, you know, para-liturgically, I guess, on the side, to the side of the Mass and to the ordinary life of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And they would meet and sort of cultivate, you know, spiritual disciplines and you know, mutual encouragement of people and stuff
right.
like that. So anyway, that sprung some offshoots. I know in France, the oratories.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who the French founder was. I forget now, but and then also the English.
Yeah, so it was kind of a movement ever since
mm-hmm.
Philip Neri, the whole idea of the oratory, and so this particular oratory played a big part in this mid 19th century conversion of a lot of high Anglicans to Catholicism,
mm-hmm.
and Newman was you know kind of the center of that. But I love, being a huge Tolkien fan myself, I love the fact that Tolkien has this connection, this geographical,
mm-hmm.
historical connection to Newman and to Hopkins for this reason, you know,
yeah.
Because he, you know, he literally, like, that was the center of his world as a young man, right? It was the Birmingham Oratory. He would go in with Father Francis Morgan, who was his guardian after his mother died. He would go and serve Mass,
Tolkien.
You know, every day. At the Birmingham Oratory.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I find that pretty cool, pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to think about the spiritual sort of radiation that hung around of, you know, Newman and Hopkins, just their maybe their presence lingering there and influencing him in his future artistic
mm-hmm.
endeavor. So
mm-hmm.
anyway, so. Just a little aside there. So he converts to Catholicism in 1867. Hopkins does. And he became a Jesuit in 1868, and he gave up poetry around that time.
Didn't he burn all his poems?
He did. He burned all of his poems up to that point, which you're just like, that's crazy.
Right.
But this is, again, that's that ascetical streak coming back.
Yeah.
Right?
He wanted a clean break, big change.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, you know, he really struggled with this throughout the rest of his life, like his draw to be creative and especially to write poetry, and that this sense that it somehow was out of place next to his religious vows and endeavors, right? To really focusing on this religious effort that he felt the call to undertake. That's an interesting little conflict in and of itself, you know.
Yeah. Deeply tortured person.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think
guy,
so.
Yeah.
You know, he was definitely very melancholic, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
his later, the dark poems at the end of his life are incredible.
Yeah?
Yes. Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
you can read one of those later sometime.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
if you
definitely.
Keep the dark show going.
So around 1875, somewhere around there, so a few years after he'd given up poetry altogether, he was asked to compose a poem about the wreck of the Deutschland, which is a ship carrying five Franciscan nuns, among others, that had sunk. And it was kind of a, you know, he was basically asked to do this by one of his religious superiors, right? Mm-hmm. So he was like, okay, well, if
he's
I'm
like,
asked
yes,
to do
I'll
it,
do it.
Yeah, he's like, all right, well, sure. If I got to write poetry, I guess.
Twist my arm.
Yeah. So, and you know, maybe he had mentally and intellectually kind of come back around to see that, like, maybe writing poetry, it does not necessarily conflict with my religious vows.
Yeah, my sense of that, I don't know, but mm-hmm. maybe I'm wrong, but I think that the guy is in his soul is a poet. He's an artist. And so doing that was very painful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think his superior wisely saw that he was a really gifted poet.
Yeah.
And, you know, said, hey, Gerard, please, would you write this poem?
Yeah.
He probably jumped all over it. It was like, you know, had sort of an authoritative.
Right. Yeah. Yes, you know, encouraging him to do the thing that,
mm-hmm.
you know, God had gifted him to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe that was even sort of his reason for giving it up, because he knew it would be a challenge for him that would be, in his mind at least, would be spiritually fruitful. But it's an interesting, I mean, I'd love to explore that aspect of his biography more, maybe find a good book like biography of him or something, mm-hmm. because, you know, like, I think there's, you know, there are a lot of times when we undertake some more rigorous ascetical practice, the church's guidance in the modern world especially is to say, like, you need a spiritual director before mm-hmm. you're going to do something crazy, right? You know, before you do something that's like, that's a lot, right? That's a lot to do. And so it'd be interesting to know whether he did this under the influence of any kind of spiritual, like, gave up poetry under any kind of spiritual direction, or if spiritual direction was like, it's not, I mean, that's the picture we have right there, is a spiritual direction was what brought poetry back to him.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That somebody encouraged him to write, you know, to write this. So from that time forward, he began to compose more poetry. In 1877, he was ordained a priest, and he became, and he was eventually went to Dublin and was the professor of Greek and Latin at the University College in Dublin. And even during this time, he still struggled with reconciling his poetic inclinations with his religious views.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1889, around 44, 45 years old, he died of typhoid fever. So he did, even though he lived this kind of extremely melancholic and ascetical life, and he was maybe bipolar, mm-hmm. he died saying, I am so happy, I loved my life. So, you know.
That was his last words?
Apparently, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that, I think, from what I remember, at University College Dublin, he didn't stay a professor for long. I think it was really difficult for him to, you know, play that role.
Yeah.
To have that position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it set well with him.
Yeah, that's the impression I got. You know, you get this impression throughout his life that he never really found his, like, his spot, you know?
Yeah.
That he never maybe found the place where he just was, like, sailing along in the world.
Yeah. I think he was happiest by himself, walking out in the woods and taking notes.
And probably writing poetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. he was a very astute observer of nature.
Yeah.
And that's really the foundation of his poetry.
Well, and there's a much longer biography if you go to, like, Poetry Foundation, the Poetry Foundation website.
Mm-hmm.
There's a super long bio of him on there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is actually, like, talks about his dad and the influence his dad had on him. And his, a lot of his dad's poetry is very similar
mm-hmm.
in certain ways to his, like, the themes of it.
Really?
Very similar to his.
Interesting.
At least, you know, maybe on a surface level, just, like, focus on nature and kind of pondering nature. So, mm-hmm.
Kind of a romantic.
Yeah.
Background.
Yeah. Well, and that was what was popular,
mm-hmm.
you know, probably when his father was coming up,
yeah.
was the romantic movement in England. So yeah, you know, an interesting life. And he was never famous during his life as a poet. He really, like, he was not known as a poet until a good 20 or 30 years after he died, when a friend of his decided to start publishing his poetry.
Robert Bridges, right? The poet.
I think that's right. Yeah,
yeah. They were really close friends.
And then ever since then, you know, it's been, he's kind of been known, Hopkins has been known as one of the, you know, one of the great poets of this era, one mm-hmm. of the great English poets mm-hmm. of this era. So
yeah, poetry is different after Hopkins.
Yeah.
you know?
It is. It is. Well, all right. So let's read. On that note, you're going to read.
I'm going to give it a shot.
As Kingfishers Catch Fire.
Take one.
Take one. And hopefully only take. But we'll see.
Let me find it, man.
I got it right here if you want to.
I got it right here, man.
Okay. He's reading from the book.
Reading from the book.
That's why Chris rolls. Doesn't read it from the screen. No, reads it from the book.
Yeah. As Kingfishers Catch Fire. As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim and roundy wells, stones ring. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bell's bow swung, finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same. Deals out that being, indoors each one dwells, selves, goes itself, myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. I say more. The just man justices, keeps grace. That keeps all his goings graces. Acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces.
It's like a high wire act. Man.
Man, I'm like, my heart's beating like crazy. That was like intense.
This is not an easy poem to, to read, folks. Yeah. This is, if you go look at it and just try to read it yourself, it's a very, of course, I think Hopkins' most famous poem is God's Grandeur. Mm-hmm. Some may argue that it's,
Record of the Ditchling? Pie Beauty?
Pie Beauty, mm. Yeah. But I think, probably the one I knew first was God's Grandeur, and God's Grandeur is not easy itself to read, but it's a little bit easier. This one has always, because I always heard this one, you know, things about this one, but mm-hmm. you really gotta spend some time with with this one to even understand like how the different phrases work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right? tough.
To really understand the phrasing itself.
Mm-hmm. What would you give me? What grade?
I'm not going to give you an A+. I'll say that. But I mean, I would only give an A+ if it was like Hopkins reading it, because he's the one that wrote it, right?
He would know.
Or maybe even not Hopkins. I probably wouldn't even give Hopkins an A. It'd probably be after some great Shakespearean orator or something like that.
Yeah.
I'd probably give you an A-.
Okay, like, man.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I wouldn't give myself.
I'll remember that.
I probably wouldn't get any more than a B, if even on my best reading. So,
all right, I feel better.
Yeah, no, it's not. I did not mean that to be insulting, but just to say that it's like this is a extremely challenging poem to read.
Yeah,
but the thing you did really well was you'd never stumbled over anything, which I guarantee you I would have had to do more than one take. Yeah. I felt like it was a high wire act. You got up to there to the end.
I felt like that too, man.
You got up there to the end and it was like, is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? You know?
Yeah.
Even like, I would have said like acts in God's eyes. You said God's eye, which is right. And I heard that and I was like, isn't it God's eyes? And I was like, okay, it is. All right. Yeah. God's eye.
All yeah.
Right. So why did you want to talk about this poem, Chris?
You know, it was a moment of inspiration that I can't understand. I was just like laying in bed thinking about what we should talk about. I looked over to my nightstand and this book was sitting there.
Oh.
And I thought, hey, let's read it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Must have been like a, angelic nudge.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well,
and, you know, we're talking about music.
Mm-hmm.
There's a musicality here.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I don't know. That's it.
Well, let's talk about musicality and other aspects of the poem. So I don't know, where do you want to start? What does this poem mean? Because that's what we're always searching for, right?
Yeah.
I want to read this quote actually. So when Chris suggested this, what was cool for me was I had when I was doing my master's work, I had done an annotation of this poem, and so I was like, oh yeah, I annotated that poem back back in 2012 when I was doing my master's work.
Which basically means you went word by word, line by line, and
trying to understand it, like looking at what other scholars had to say about it, and and really understanding like what does each thing mean, so that I could arrive at a final sort of thought on what was Hopkins trying to communicate overall through this poem. But mm-hmm. But that's the interesting thing about poetry in general, right? Like, this is a quote from Jane Hirschfield, and she says, "The work of poetry is not simply to record perception, but to make by words the possibility of a new perceiving, to open us into the distinctive realms we see when we see the world by poem light." I really like that, because to me, the study of literature and even just creative effort itself is, it's not just about recording something. You record something in a documentary fashion, right? Like, that's what documentary, essay, those sorts of things are for. Prose, are for. But more creative music, even like musical works like this, they're intended to open up to help us see things in a different light, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe even a greater light than we normally see the world. Right.
It's like, you know, to take a very small example, like a metaphor.
Yeah.
If I said love is a rose,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in a poem or in a song, I wouldn't look at roses the same ever again.
Right.
Nor love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sort of expands our comprehension of the nature of things.
Yeah, and I would even go so far as to say that, you know, it's nudging us toward a sacramental view of reality, right? That's one of the things that poetry does in general, mm-hmm. you know, that music does, right? That it helps us to see the interconnectedness of reality, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. hopefully at root to draw you ever nearer, you know, the burning heart of God, right? Yeah. The love of God.
So hopefully I understand roses better when I mm-hmm. use that metaphor, and the same thing about love.
Right.
But I have a deeper, richer understanding of the two.
Most definitely. So, and that's one of the things we're about in the Red Lamp District, is we want to like elevate our way of seeing the world, right? I like what she says there with poem light. Mm-hmm. When we see the world by poem light,
mm-hmm.
To open us up to the distinctive realms we see when we see the world by poem light. So, one thing I'll start off by saying is that this is a Petrarchan sonnet.
Okay.
So, most of our listeners from schooling are probably familiar with Shakespearean sonnets at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare wrote a lot of sonnets, but his sonnet was of different style. So all sonnets are 14 lines. Shakespeare's followed a pattern where the first, where there was like basically 12, A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F kind of quatrains, right?
Okay.
So there were three quatrains, which totaled 12 lines. And then there would be a couplet at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like the final thought, right, of the poem.
Yeah, resolution.
Yeah. Petrarchan sonnet comes from a period before Shakespeare. And the format there is A, B, B, A, A, B, B, A. And then
that's the rhyme scheme.
That's the rhyme scheme. Yeah. And then you have some format. So you have an octet, right, is the first half of the poem, the first 8 lines.
Yep.
And then you have a sestet, mm-hmm. which is the last 6 lines.
And there's sort of a change, right?
Exactly.
What happens there from the 8th to...
Apparently, that's called the first line of the sestet. It's called the volta.
Uh-huh.
And it's like... It's like a kind of a big statement, right? To maybe it can be contrarian towards the first 8 lines, or it can be like it can take things to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
But it's supposed to be a standout, you know, standout sort of line. So
yeah.
That line here is, "I say more, the just man justices."
Right.
Right. So just that little thing of "I say more," like that's a mm-hmm. good example of the volta.
Yeah. So the first part of the poem,
mm-hmm.
the octet.
Mm-hmm.
It's about natural things.
Yeah.
Well, not even natural things, but also, I mean, we've got a string that's plucked or tucked.
Right.
Maybe on a guitar or a violin. We've got a bell.
Mm-hmm.
We've got rocks or stones being thrown into a well, making their specific noise.
Right.
We've got kingfishers, I guess, diving down to catch a fish.
Yeah.
And they catch fire. Dragonflies, I don't know, buzzing through the air. And then, you know, he's describing that each mortal thing does one thing in the same. It does itself.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, it does itself. So uniquely and perfectly. And, but then the "I say more," he turns to humanity.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, in the first, in that first octet, you know, it's reflecting on, It's when it says it deals out, so it deals out itself, deals out that being indoors each one dwells. That seems like very philosophical language there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about, I've heard the name, but I really don't know like what the distinguishing aspects of this individual's philosophy, but apparently Duns Scotus was very influential on Hopkins.
Huge. Yeah.
And that's right. I don't know if that's significant philosophically in sort of that reflection here.
It is.
But maybe you can say something about that.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Yeah, just quickly. Scotus was a very important medieval Franciscan, English Franciscan philosopher,
okay,
theologian. And one of the basic concepts of his is called haechaitas.
Okay.
Sort of like individualness or... Mm-hmm. Like the particular identity of the thing. It's sort
interesting.
Of, it's something like the total uniqueness of each particular thing,
yeah,
that it possesses that distinguishes it from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of incontrovertible or something that, you know, is essential to each thing.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally in history of philosophy, universal categories were more important.
You know, right.
I look at Socrates, I look at Plato, and I look at you. And I can, and the most important thing that you got about you three is what you share together, which mm-hmm. is the nature of humanity, this overarching category that's real, you know, and you're just sort of iterations of it.
Okay.
Your individuality and your particular uniqueness is
mm-hmm.
Secondary.
Okay.
Whereas after St. Francis, who was sort of a, you know, focused on the particular uniqueness of things
mm-hmm.
spiritually, his tradition, the Franciscan intellectual tradition, came to see things in a new way, and it's sort of the background behind so much of the modern world.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can go into that some other time, but
mm-hmm.
So anyway, so Duns Scotus sort of theorized these, this sort of trend,
mm-hmm.
the intellectual trend to see things, the uniqueness of things is basic to reality and on par with universal categories.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So like in a way here, then, you know, each thing, each individual thing, like, in its action, right, it kind of proclaims itself, right? It proclaims its own inner self.
Yeah.
Right?
Can't help it.
Yeah. You know, the stone throw down the well, right? As it rings, as it goes down the well, right? It's proclaiming itself.
Mm-hmm.
The tuck string tells itself, right? Mm-hmm. When it tucked, it's an old-fashioned word for plucking the string, mm-hmm. right? Each hung bell's bow swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name, right?
Right.
I am a bell, right?
Yeah.
I am a bell, right?
That's what I do. That's
each mortal do. Thing does one thing in the same, deals out that being which is inside of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Myself, it speaks and spells.
Yeah, yeah. So good.
I like to say it. It selves, right?
Yeah, that's all I do. All I do is self.
Yeah.
You know, everything I do is me doing it.
Yeah.
It's unique to me. It's the very particular thing. That bell being hit, you know, the... I don't know what you call the parts of a bell, but the thing that the piece that hits the side when it's swung.
Yeah.
It has a very unique sound that's particular to its size, its dimension.
I think the technical term is the dinger.
Oh yeah. The tongue.
Yeah.
The dinger.
The dinger.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So my boys insist home runs should be called stingers. They're like, Dad,
I hit dingers.
It's a dinger, not a home run.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It flings out, yeah. Flings out broad its name. I feel like that's a very, you know, And I don't think Hopkins meant it in this way, but I feel like that's a very that the first part of this poem reflects strongly like a very like a spirit of the like a spirit of our age, like in terms of what art is supposed to do. It's like express myself.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Art is supposed to express myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to draw a critical eye towards that necessarily right now. That's maybe a discussion for another time. But that's important because that's not really the final word from Hopkins here, right? Because this is the octet.
Yeah. But yeah,
it's significant. Like, and I think he agrees with the things he says.
Everything that he sees, exactly.
Yeah.
Everything he sees, he looks. He's enchanted by the very particular uniqueness, the way each particular thing,
mm-hmm.
and doing its particular thing, like nothing else. The way in which it reflects something higher.
Yeah, I mean, it's an aspect of beauty in the world,
yeah.
right?
So everything is a sign or a symbol,
and it can bring. It's that. I mean, that octet in itself is a way of seeing the world that can be. Renewing, right, and refreshing, right,
mm-hmm.
to because like in the reality of the world we live in is that we're led to see the world as being like mass produced, right, like things without uniqueness,
yeah,
and
styrofoam cups,
right? And but like Hopkins here is saying that like each thing has its own uniqueness, mm-hmm. right?
Each snowflake.
Yeah, I knew the snowflake was going to come up, right? The each
fingerprints
precious
snowflake,
each precious snowflake.
Yeah.
So there is a way of going overboard with that mentality as well, and you know, and kind of teaching everybody, you know, that they're like,
yeah. This is an important point that you made a second ago, was, you know, the sort of modern individualism mm-hmm. and self-expression as being, you know, so much a part of, you know, we feel happy today when we are fulfilling our particular passions or desires,
right?
You know, and everything else is in the way of that. So we're sort of have this sort of individualist, mm-hmm. very strong. But the theoretical, the background to that is actually the medieval theologians who came up with these ideas. Not that they were going that direction with it, but condition for the possibility of whether good or bad today, and a mix of both it is,
right?
Happened in it's medieval.
Well, it can be isolating. If that's all you have to say about it, then that uniqueness can be isolating, because if you don't reflect upon the things that do unite us, right, the things mm-hmm. we hold in common, then you live in an isolated universe. If you're like, I am just a individual snowflake and you can't understand me, then that in itself is isolating, unless you can say, yes, I have my uniqueness, but I'm also a snowflake, right? Like all the other snowflakes, right? And we hold that in common.
Right.
So there's
you just said I am a snowflake.
Well, yeah.
That was amazing.
I am, Chris. I am a precious snowflake, and you need to respect my uniqueness. And my delicateness. You bring all these ideas together, and you can see how if you get away from kind of the core Trinitarian idea of the one and the many, right?
Yep.
That you can
being co-absolute,
you can get into a problem, right? If you mm-hmm. don't hold those two things together. So let's talk about the sestet.
Yeah.
The resolution, or taking it to the next level, kicking it up a notch.
Which I think is what he's doing here. I say more.
Yeah, I say more.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You want me to give a shot?
Well, go ahead. Yeah, I can, okay. Or you can.
I'll start it.
All right.
So here we are, returning to humanity, the unique creature that we are. This is tough, man. This line, I say more, the just man justices, mm-hmm. keeps grace. And then you got a colon after grace, keeps grace. That or that, I think it's that, keeps all his goings graces. Like mm-hmm. that, pointing to that.
Right.
I guess, which is. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. Like, there's he puts these accent marks in a couple of places. I think there's three in the poem. I say more. That's the first one. More,
yeah.
and then right here, that keeps all his goings graces. I think those are supposed to be like point to those words and say this is like the emphasis should be on this
part
word.
Of the rhythm. Like the
right.
I think he calls it sprung rhythm.
Yeah, sprung. Yeah, that's one thing about Hopkins, is his style was all about this sprung rhythm concept.
Right.
So, he says, "I say so." More is the first one that keeps all his goings graces.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you read that again, so I say more, the just man justices keeps grace that keeps all his goings graces. Right, I think that's the right way to read it, but maybe somebody who's listening knows better and can speak to that a little bit better.
I think a simple schema for at least getting into this.
Yeah,
I don't want to go too far with it
mm-hmm.
for theological reasons, but we can talk about that too. Is the distinction between nature and grace?
Yeah,
so you're talking about natural things
mm-hmm.
at the beginning, and then grace is something that undergirds, it's behind everything. But with humanity in particular, we have a vocation to go beyond our nature, which actually fulfills our nature.
Right.
But it's also a gift that can only be given to us.
Right.
So it's a paradox.
Yeah.
But when he wants to say more, he's talking about the grace dimension. And then he goes right into, jumps right into it, keeps grace. And sort of, I think it's meant to evoke the vocation or calling we have in our uniqueness. And I guess each particular human being's irreplaceable uniqueness to keep grace.
Yeah.
To keep all his goings graces, to act in God's eye what in God's eye he is. And that is Christ.
Christ.
So it's the paradox deepens, you know, that the Christ is the God-man,
mm-hmm.
fully divine and fully human. So there's this paradox that Christ reveals to us about how our nature is meant to go beyond its nature in order to fulfill its nature. But that can't be accomplished except by a gift from the divine.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
That's Christ.
Yeah.
Christ gives us that. He is that. And that he's the true human one. The the most truly unique, perfect exemplification of what humanity is. And also, he's the fully divine one.
So, well, and what sticks out to me here is that what he's saying is that in God's eyes, we are Christ, right? Like, that's what we are meant to be in the eyes of God, is Christ.
Yeah. So is Christ the just man?
I mean, I think so.
Justicing? To justice?
There's an overlapping nature of, like, many different ways that these lines can seem to be taken,
right? That's one of the keys to Hopkins, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and I think that's one of the keys to, like, good poetry and you know, good lyrics and those sorts of things.
Way.
Like, there's a multitude of different ways that things can be taken and understood. Like, you know, it can mean something to one person in a particular situation. And I'm not arguing for complete relativity in the meaning of literary text.
Yes.
I do think there's things that it doesn't mean. But, you know, different people might hear different things. But I think what's important here is that Hopkins intends a lot of this ambiguity so that there's...
And double entendre.
So that we have to more deeply reflect upon the overlapping meaning in these things.
Yeah.
So, like, the just man justices, right? So the just man, I mean, that could just be, like, any, like, man who is just, right? The Christian who is just, right? What does he do? He justices, right? He lives out justice.
Which is something, what we're called to.
Right.
It is what it means to be the image.
Mm-hmm.
Partly.
Yeah.
The image of God.
And keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, right? So, he keeps, like, there's two meanings to that, right? He keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, right? That he keeps on the way of grace because he keeps grace, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he keeps grace also, and that thing ensures that, you know, his grace is, that his ways are all going to be filled with grace. So, yes. You know, there's...
Yeah, to keep means also to guard and...
Right. But yeah, I think the key line here is really acts in God's eye, what in God's eye he is. Christ.
Mm-hmm.
For Christ plays in 10,000 places, right? And that 10,000 number, I mean, that might as well be 10 billion or 10 trillion,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
This is saying that, like, Christ, you know, Christ is a unique human person. But sacramentally, he is all Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And all human beings are called to be that. Mm.
He's also the principle for all natural things.
Right.
So he's the one through whom all things are made.
Well,
so,
he's the Logos,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just going to mention this about... So this poem is sort of a microcosm of Hopkins' thought in general, because that using that idea, that concept of individual uniqueness from Scotus, and ipseity or selfness, that's why he studied nature so much, why he saw the kingfisher. He wanted to capture its essence and its particular uniqueness as he saw it doing its thing.
Right.
You know, jumping from the limb to catch the fish, diving down. Each one of those things, when he caught that hycheatos of the thing, he truly thought that's where he literally sees Jesus there.
Hmm.
He literally finds that unique thing that reflects the very unique and particular thing that makes that thing distinct from everything else is precisely where it's closest to God.
Yeah,
that's where it becomes an icon to the divine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he studied these things and wanted to find that uniqueness of the bell, the dragonfly, the clouds. He studied clouds a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He always looked for. He thought when he found that sort of the skin between the temporal world and the eternal world could be sort of passed through and see. He could see Jesus.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's cool. Deep thoughts, man.
Yeah.
This all, like, I keep coming back and think is when we talk about this, I keep coming back to having pets and seeing, like, in your, you know, I know you have a dog.
Mm-hmm.
I have cats.
Yep.
I think about the first octet and I think about my cats and, like, their unique expression of, like, catness, right? And just like that exists for this. And we have kind of a running joke with my family of like, you know, like when you're like bad cat and you know, you're like, you know, they do something bad or something like that. And like, well, he's just being a cat. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and, and like you know, when we do something bad, it's like, well, you know, you talk to the kids, like, or if, you know, if you've done something bad, well, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe mention that the next time we go to confession or something like that. And, but, you know, then, but Bailey, the cat, even though he did something bad in our eyes, you know, he can't go to confession because he doesn't have a mortal soul, right? He doesn't have this aspect to him, right?
Right.
So he's just being a cat,
yeah,
right? Doing right. what a cat does.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there's also this unique, of the two cats, there's this unique expression within both of them of like different
catnesses,
different cat natures,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
Even though they have the same. Yeah.
If one of those individuals is missing, you don't understand cat nature as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, cat nature, you see, it can be a funny thing sometimes, mm-hmm. as it can be with dogs.
Yeah.
I've had dogs in different times in the past. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's, but to think about that, like they exist for, and you know, to think about what Hopkins may be saying here, they exist for their own expression, right? Of the cat nature. They're, you know, yes, everything in the end exists for God, but they're not necessarily to be mindful of God in the way that we are as human beings,
mm-hmm.
right? And
yeah.
they're more just kind of going about doing their cat business, and that pleases God,
yeah.
right? That they are doing the things that cats are yeah. supposed to do,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And, but for us, like there's a higher level that we're called to,
mm-hmm.
right? As human beings to be Christ.
Yeah.
To be Christ in our particular situation.
Right.
And that seems to be what Hopkins is getting to here,
mm-hmm.
for mankind, that we are called to be Christ.
Yeah.
And whatever of the 10,000 places that we, you know, that we find ourselves in. And so it ends, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. So it's almost like it's this Pauline idea of like Christ living out in each of us, right? It's not
mm-hmm.
I who live, but Christ who lives in me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that makes me think of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that Christ is a player. So he's an actor. He's sort of the... I think that's the image, because right before it, I saw something else. Maybe I thought I saw, oh, he's acting in God's eye. So I thought there was mm-hmm. a sort of a theater dimension to it. That
yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Christ animates, you know, he's behind everything. He's the one through whom that you can see as the player behind.
That's really fascinating to think about that.
Things
like
in us.
That each man's life is this struggle for Christ to live through him. Right, like
yeah.
that. Christ desires to live through each man,
yeah,
through each human being, and that's really the kind of like the struggle of each individual human life
yeah.
is to realize that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, I think this is right. So if that image of Christ is an actor,
mm-hmm.
he's acting to or before the Father,
mm-hmm.
so that you know that the creation is an unfolding thing for God's delight. And God enters that creation and animates it and suffuses it and draws it up to, you know, towards the divine sphere. And that act of animation and suffusing and drawing up the creation to the Father is Christ's work.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, man. It's good stuff.
Yeah. So it's good.
Most definitely. So, So yeah, that's As Kingfishers Catch Fire. That's our take on it. Go read it yourself. We'll try to find some other readings of it and link to those in the show notes, so that you can get a better feel for maybe how other people might approach reading it. But Hopkins' poetry, very much worth checking out if you're not familiar with it, or revisiting.
Read it out loud.
Yeah,
read it out loud.
Yeah, find other people to read it to. Be like, I don't care what you think. I'm going to read you this Hopkins poem.
Yeah, yeah.
But you might want to practice first, because it can be challenging if you just try to go and read it off the bat.
Don't be nervous.
Yeah. I think that is all for today for episode 6. So thank you for listening, and we will look forward to talking at you next time.
Thanks, y'all.
Peace out.